You didn't run, you didn't lie, you knew I wanted just to hold you.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. It's the 14th of August. I'd say it's a lovely day.
For now.
All right.
The day is young.
The day is young. We'll see. Aaron, our little ray of sunshine. Good morning, everyone. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we'll get started. Very nice to have you. We have a lot to talk about, as always. So Aaron Pisidia is here. Normally would be with us on Friday. But on Friday we're going to be at Tanglewood, so he is here today with us, and we're thrilled. He is a economics professor at Siena College in Loudonville, New York, and it's a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
J.P. Miller is one of our Tuesday regulars, and in fact, the rest of our panelists are our Tuesday regulars. J.P. Miller is here. He is the Empire Reports. J.P. Miller. The man behind the Empire Report, and you were not here last week, or the
haven't been here the last 2 weeks, but I'm very happy to be here today, Joe.
Good, good.
Thank you for having me.
He's good. Rested, he's tanned, he's ready to go.
Yes,
that sounded like a prepared statement, JP. Yes. Just to say,
and he's still very tall.
Yes, Libby Post, you don't usually lose height on vacation.
No, I don't.
Think I don't.
No.
Libby Post, who I have to say made my life because I was enjoying vacation very much, and then Libby posted a picture of her new puppy, and then
yes.
I got so excited.
Yes,
I was just
did.
I was over the moon. This is Shayna, I believe, is
yes.
the name of the little golden
uh-huh.
retriever, who is how old?
12 weeks.
Oh my God! So you are a new parent.
Yes, and my shoes will never get dried out because you know you have to take them out, and it's been raining.
Oh, I see. I thought it was
she's
because
she's not peeing on my shoes now.
No, I didn't even think that. I thought because normally with they have those little puppy teeth, and they take your shoes.
It's about taking her out every few hours.
Yeah,
even in the middle of the night. So
you'll be all right.
I'm fine with it. She is the cutest little thing, as we can all see here.
A little powder puff.
She is
very nice.
Isn't she cute, Mike?
Very nice.
She's adorable. I can verify that on Libby's Facebook page. There's an adorable golden retriever puppy.
Yes,
looks so happy.
We should. Yes. We'll. I'll try to put a picture up.
Oh, good.
On our thing.
I'll send
yeah,
you.
I would
okay.
love to.
You want me to send you one?
Sure.
You, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
This will happen instantly now.
Yes,
it will.
then, so people can see your pup. Then, Mike Spain is with us. He is the associate editor of the Times Union. Thrilled to have you with us as always, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Also, Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning and welcome back.
Well, it's
always great to see you.
It's good to be back. All right, let's go. Let's start with all the fun. I miss talking about stuff. Well, I was just doing it with my family, and that's not nearly as fun as talking about it with you guys. All right, so we'll begin with there's a lot of places to begin, but I guess we can start with Turkey. We'll start with Turkey and what is happening with their currency. We have an economist here, for goodness sake, so let's do that. Turkey's lira crisis tests Erdogan's authoritarian approach. The President Erdogan has long made clear that he considered no part of Turkish life beyond his reach, not least the economy. Even before he was reelected in June, with sultan-like powers, he had built his popularity on sustained economic growth fueled by signature megaprojects, the latest being plans for a canal bisecting the country. But critics have long charged that much of that expansion was built on budgetary sleight of hand, cronyism, and corruption. Now, Turkey's worst economic crisis since 2001, the currency hit another new low on Monday, has confronted Mr. Erdogan with the limits of his authoritarian approach and could end his long run of success. That from the New York Times.
Okay. So
I've just put the ball on the tee, Aaron.
All right. So Turkey is what economists call an emerging market, in that they're not quite a first world country, but certainly not a third world country. So Turkey's got the world's 17th largest economy. They've got a 10% unemployment rate, which is higher than the industrial world average, and a 15% inflation rate. So it's a relatively small economy, all things considered. And what's happening now is really the chickens coming home to roost, that Erdogan's policy has been pretty standard for a lot of emerging economies with heavy-handed state control. Like Joe pointed out, a lot of government spending has gone to fund these mega projects like bridges, canals, airports, and highways. You couple that with very low interest rates, which makes it cheap for investors to borrow money and invest in these projects. And what you get is very stimulative economic policy. The problem with that is, one, that it can lead to high inflation, and that's what you've seen in Turkey. The inflation rates tripled over the past, I think, like 8 years. And now what's happening is that the Turkish lira is declining in value. And without getting into the details of what an exchange rate is, you can look at it as kind of a proxy for how confident investors are in the Turkish economy. Mm. So during the post-recession years from like 2010 to 2016, 2017, you had really low interest rates, which meant it was cheap for banks to borrow. Banks saw really high returns available on these Turkish projects. So a lot of foreign capital flooded into Turkey to help boost growth in that country, which it did. It also boosted a lot of inflation as well. So you have this inflow of foreign capital, which boosts investment and boosts growth. And then this is very similar to what happened in Southeast Asia in 1997, where all of a sudden foreign investors decide something's wrong, that maybe these growth rates aren't sustainable. Maybe something's a little fishy with Erdogan's nomination of his son-in-law to be the director of economic policy, and they decide the good times are over.
So, Aaron, let me intervene and ask you a question, because the way that the press has been playing this is that there's a Trump component in all of this, that there's a political component. I wonder if you speak to that.
Not now. And I don't think there has been for the past decade. I know Trump's weighed in on this with the threat to double the aluminum and steel tariffs.
Right.
Why is he doing that, do you think?
Okay, so when exchange rates go down, which is what's happening in Turkey, it makes Turkish exports to the rest of the world really cheap. So Turkey actually has an kind of a shadow advantage here, in that a low exchange rate means that any product Turkey exports to the rest of the world will be about 50% cheaper than it was a year ago. So Trump sees this as a threat to U.S. economic steel and aluminum production, because Turkey could export steel aluminum to the U.S. for much cheaper than any other country in the world right now. So Trump's trying to kind of counter that with his America First policy by saying, no, we're going to put tariffs on this to kind of mute that competitive advantage Turkey could get.
Yes, but what about Erdogan and his conviction that the United States is in on, you know, the coup that they had, and that we're not letting this guy out of here who they want to bring back to Turkey, and that they have somebody that we want who has basically been arrested?
That's a possibility. I think a lot of Western democracies don't really like Erdogan's, emperor for life policies and, doing whatever he wants. And I think the way he dealt with that was to prove to the Turkish people through highly stimulative government spending and low interest rate policy that they don't need to listen to the rest of the world, because he's delivering jobs, he's delivering wage growth, he's delivering economic growth to the country, and that finally is starting to crack.
And yet he's claiming that our president is the great Satan.
Well, he hasn't used those terms, but I think it's probably politically useful for Erdogan to blame this on the
right.
United States.
Sure.
When what you're saying, I think, is that this is really his own doing.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what he's doing is a really small scale version of what China's been doing, and that is to use government spending to boost economic growth on these infrastructure projects, and to keep interest rates really low, which makes it cheap for Turkish banks to borrow and fund these projects. And if you don't have the output, the output to back that up, then you get rising inflation. So, yeah, he's looking for a boogeyman, and Trump is the obvious
candidate. You mean he's
candidate.
Choosing Trump as the boogeyman?
Yeah, I can't imagine why he'd want to do that.
Is that plausible?
There's another way to look at this, and you know, back when I went to Hunter College, we had to read sociology, and there was a sociologist who did a study of the most unpopular people in the world. And the Turks were always number one. They're not, they weren't like us, and therefore they were always easy to pick on.
Why?
Well, I think differences in religion and, okay, you know, and things of that kind. Even though the Turks have been great allies of right, the United States.
That's the
they've
issue.
They've been wonderful.
Right.
That's the issue. In that part of the world, they have been our staunch ally. And losing that could very well undermine, even further erode, our credibility in the world and, you know, our foreign policy. But what I find interesting is that Erdogan and Trump are cut out of the same cloth. I mean, if Trump had his way, he would have that Sultan-like ability to be president for life. You know, and, you know, Erdogan put his son-in-law in, right? And,
oh, boy,
and,
can't do that.
Right, and Trump put Jared Kushner on some kind of job. I'm not quite sure what it is.
It changes from day to day.
Yeah, it does change from day to day. And so, you know, on one level, they're very much alike. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, whether or not, you know, after all of this sword fighting, you know, Trump invites Erdogan to the White House and he's going to be a great guy, just like Putin and North Korea. So
I think the issue, I mean, so there's another aspect to this, and this is something JP and I were talking about, is what are the risks of contagion? Is this going to be just limited to Turkey?
Right. What's the effect on the world economy?
So, you know, in 2006, Ben Bernanke said the cracks in the housing market aren't going to have any type of contagion effects.
Yeah, sure.
And we all saw what happened with that. So, you know.
So you're not going to predict anything.
So I'm not going to predict anything. But
right. We have a bridge we'd like to sell you.
So what happens is that when exchange rates go down, Turkey needs more and more lira to repay international creditors. So what they do is they print more and more money to pay those debts, which leads to higher inflation. And you have the same, and then, you know, they have
spiral,
the same problem,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
the death spiral. So to the extent there's going to be contagion, it seems at this point to primarily be limited to European Union banks, who seem to be the main creditors in a lot of these projects. And since Turkey's not that big of an economy, the contagion effects are probably limited to the EU, and they'll probably be relatively mild. I hope I don't regret saying that. In terms of world contagion, I have a really tough time seeing this spill out to, you know, the U.S., Germany, England, and some of the larger economies.
Well, you just said the EU, though, and if it does spill out into the EU, doesn't that play into Putin's desire to weaken it?
Oh, sure.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, this would be a blessing in disguise for,
yes,
Putin's overall world,
well,
military objectives.
The last one that we're familiar with, economic crisis in that part of the world, was Greece's economy, mm-hmm, and they seem to be stabilizing. How does this rack up? And is it bigger or smaller? I mean, how does this compare to what we watched with Greece?
So Greece was a much smaller economy,
oh, okay,
but they had a much more populist movement that was threatening to upend the global financial order by saying, guess what? We're not repaying any of our creditors, and deal with it. And then obviously if that happens, then you have a domino effect where all of these banks lose money and the banks that lend those banks money start failing. And what happened was at the very last minute, the IMF came in to rescue Greece. So Turkey's got two options here, and they can take the Asian approach, which was used in 1997, which is you impose really strict capital controls, laws that prevent banks from withdrawing money from Turkish investments. And that's a very heavy-handed approach, and it's certainly something well within Erdogan's reach. And then you tell those international investors, hey, this is the risk. You're going to take a haircut. We're not going to be repaying all of these debts. Deal with it. That's what Malaysia did. That's what Argentina did, and that's what Iceland did. And those economies really, really suffered in the first two or three years following that decision, but they recovered very rapidly from that. The alternative approach, which is what Mike brought up, is that the IMF comes in and says, all right, reduce government spending, pay back your creditors, and you're going to suffer a decade-long recession, which is what happened to Greece. So, I mean, it's kind of a lesser of two evils, and which path Erdogan wants to choose is largely unknown at this point. But given his political leanings, I don't see it out of the question that he would impose some type of capital controls and have that very heavy-handed state approach to say—
He's making that clear. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think he would probably very, very adamantly resist an IMF bailout because it shows that his policy failed.
So in the minute that we have left before a break, are we seeing the climax, if you will, right now, or will it get worse before it gets better?
It'll probably get worse before it gets better. It just depends on how quickly Erdogan imposes capital controls and tells investors you're going to take a haircut on these loans, or the IMF comes in. So I think it's still going to continue to get worse.
Very quickly, you mentioned his political leanings. Maybe to our audience, you should explain what his political leanings are.
Authoritarian, that whatever he says is law and is right, and it's beyond question.
All right, so make up your own joke, right?
The Greek?
The punchline on that should be pretty obvious.
Yes,
the
okay.
The Greeks must be having a field day right now because, as you know, things have not always gone well between the two countries.
No. Yes. So, yes. I'll leave that to speculation.
Okay, so we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We have a room full of panelists, a room full of opinions, and a room full of topics, so we're in good shape. Aaron Pisidius here, J.P. Miller. Libby Post and Mike Spain, Alan Chartok is here. We welcome your letters. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will read those and talk about other stuff after this.
You say you'll be mine, boy, till the end of time. These days, such a kind boy seems so hard to find. Someday.
Barb Younger is singing there, and from an album, to be more specific, it's from a show called Come Together. Barb Younger and John McDaniel perform the Beatles, and they're going to be at the Ankrum Opera House in Ankrum on Saturday, August 18th, ankrumoperahouse.com for more information. So we'll be hearing Barb and John and their Beatles stuff this morning.
Cool
and
band.
If you want to see an entire playlist, you can go to our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Okay, let's go to the letter, and then we'll move
Actually,
on to others soon.
There are two. One says, good morning. Welcome back, Joe, with 5 explanation points. I missed you. Hope you had a great vacation.
It was lovely. Thank you.
That's very good. And then we heard from Janos in Great Barrington. When your economist was defining the problems in Turkey, large infrastructure spending, cheap loans, etc., I thought you were defining U.S. monetary policy for the past 30 years. What is keeping U.S. currency from going down the same path? $21 trillion debt and counting.
Yeah, but the U.S. hasn't been investing in infrastructure, as anybody who's taken Amtrak or a public bus recently or driven along an interstate knows.
Sure.
U.S. debt levels are pretty much on average with international debt-to-GDP ratios. Our deficit, aside from during the recession, has been under control. A big reason why is that we have an independent central bank, and which means that political influence can't have an impact on the interest rates the Federal Reserve sets. So when inflation gets out of control, like it is in Turkey, what would happen in the U.S. is that the Federal Reserve would raise interest rates, much to the dismay of politicians, because that would slow the economy. So when you have an independent, a non-independent central bank like Turkey, where political leaders can influence those decisions, spending is always popular, so you get really high inflation.
But you still Aaron, you still have a president who appoints the chair of that board.
Correct, but they operate. So you can nominate people who have certain leanings, but when it gets into monetary economics, it's a fairly narrow sliver of political views within that. These are academics. These are people who are public servants. There might be some financiers. They all understand the risks of rising inflation, and they all understand the risks of rising unemployment, and they have done an exceptional job in balancing that over the past 30 years.
So now to the central question, how many notebooks will you go through in an average summer?
I think this is number three.
Yeah, wow, that's very impressive.
If I don't write it down, I forget it.
No, well it's very good. And but you retained it, too.
But I retained
it. That's also, yeah. Also impressive. Oh, very good. So there's this one thing. There's a letter here, and I'll let Alan read it, but I just want to set it up first. And that is the story from, you know, the president was in the region yesterday,
yeah.
And he warned Andrew Cuomo, anyone who runs against me will suffer.
He said Cuomo told him he would not run against him.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure they're confidence, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's daring Cuomo. So the letter you have there says.
I'll read it from Nancy, who says, comment question. I'd love to hear Alan's comments on Trump's threat that anyone who runs against him will get hurt. I thought my astonishment could not grow, but I was wrong. That's from Nancy and Troy. Well, Nancy, my comment back to you is, what's new? I mean, this guy will say anything at any time, and you never know what's going to come out of his mouth yet. But basically, if you take a look at the whole way he has conducted himself, I think the comparison to Erdogan and Putin and all those other guys is pretty close.
But in that war of words between Cuomo and Trump, who do you side with?
Well, let me put it this way. Well, that's a very good point.
Cuomo.
That's a very good point.
Sorry.
Well, no, that's a very good point. You know, there are certain similarities in the personas of both guys, let's face it. But they're both making out like bandits. If Trump attacks Cuomo, he's great with his base.
Mm-hmm.
If Trump, bring it on.
Right.
It's all good for him. So it's a win-win there.
Okay, all right, another letter.
Okay,
yep.
Steve says, ignorant, ham-handed tariffs. What if Trump personally and directly causing Turkey's economic crisis by being an authoritarian tyrant with his ignorant, ham-handed tariffs?
So the reason... So when a country's exchange rate goes down, their exports become cheaper. So I think Trump is trying to prevent Turkey from gaining a competitive advantage, at least in terms of its exports of steel and aluminum to the U.S. I'm sure Turkey's steel and aluminum exports make up a very, very, very small percentage of all U.S. Steel and aluminum imports. So I think this is Trump just... thumping his chest.
Wanting to get into the news story.
Yeah. Right, right. He's trying to insert himself in this somehow, even though whatever policy he does is probably going to have a very minimal impact on what's going on in Turkey. This is a tidal wave, and Trump's trying to, you know, throw some sand into it.
Well, Aaron Pacetti, I am astounded by how much credit you give him for getting down in the economic weeds and thinking Trump and thinking this thing through. When I think this guy is almost always more on my side of the table, the political side, what is going to give me some benefit here?
Sure. Yeah. No, I don't think he's thinking about, well, a falling exchange rate changes the balance of trade between the U.S. and Turkey and that we can rectify this, blah, 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 blah. He's, like JP said, trying to insert himself into what's becoming a fairly large international news story. So, yeah. What was the word, ham-handed or ham-fisted?
Ham-handed. Yeah.
How about stupid?
Well,
okay,
yeah.
We'll take that. Sure.
Me too.
All right, let's move on to other topics, and then we'll before we go to another break, and let's move on with the Strzok story, which is, remember that FBI agent who criticized Trump and the text and testified. Was it last month, I believe, testified? Well, he's been fired. Peter Strzok, the FBI senior counterintelligence agent who disparaged President Trump in inflammatory text messages and helped oversee the Hillary Clinton email and Russia investigations, has been fired for violating bureau policies, according to Strzok's lawyer. Mr. Trump and his allies seized on the text exchanged during the 2016 campaign with a former FBI lawyer, Lisa Page, and assailing the Russia investigations as an illegitimate witch hunt. Mr. Strzok, who rose over 20 years at the FBI to become one of its most experienced counterintelligence agents, was a key figure in the early months of the inquiry. Along with writing the text, he was accused of sending a highly sensitive search warrant to his personal email account. The FBI has been under immense political pressure by Mr. Trump to dismiss Mr. Strzok, who was removed last summer from the staff of the special counsel Robert Mueller. The president has repeatedly denounced Strzok in posts on Twitter and on Monday expressed satisfaction that he had been sacked.
So the attack on the FBI is one of the more interesting things that has happened here. You know, you go back in history and you see some of the great dictators who got rid of the special services in their countries and replace them with their own. And if you're wondering who specifically I'm looking at, I was thinking of Hitler. You know, who did exactly that. So the FBI obviously is under a lot of pressure. His FBI, run by a Republican, with a Republican investigator, Mr. Mueller, going after him and the rest of it, it doesn't bother him a whit. You know, he's after these guys. Now, I love the fact that Strzok got up before the Congress and did what we'd all like to do. He spit in their eyes, in their collective eyes. He really let them have it. And I thought that was wonderful. You know, I think he was sort of a hero as far as I was concerned. What's interesting is that the FBI brass had decided he was going to have to take a pay cut because of what he had done. You know, he's entitled to his political opinions, but anyway, what he had done and, you know, and get fined a little bit, but they said, no, you have to be fired. And that's when it really gets dangerous. That's what Joe McCarthy was used to.
Yeah, but I think that the problem is that Strzok, as brilliant as he was, and he was his top investigator and counterintelligence investigator, et cetera, by allowing himself to become a tool in this alternate narrative that Trump has put out, that the FBI is against me, all he has to do is put those tweets out that or those messages out, instant messages that that Strzok had made to this woman who also was at the FBI. They were personal opinions. You're right. You're entitled to your personal opinions. Plenty of professional people act completely objectively and professional, even though they have personal opinions. But in this particular case, by getting those written down and also sending a search warrant or something to his personal email, he gave Trump the ammunition Trump needs to present a case to his supporters. See what I told you? This is it. The deep state after me. It's all bad. See, it's all wrong. No collusion. No collusion. But this is exactly what happened.
But is it a fireable offense?
Right. Oh, you know, it could be. I mean, sending a confidential search warrant to your private email, that's pretty much a violation of rules.
But, Mike, who are you talking about here? You're talking about a president of the United States who has quadrupled anything that this guy has done in terms of his personal opinions and his professional
role.
That has
nothing to do with it at all.
It has everything to do with it.
No, I mean, you're looking at it objectively. I'm looking at it from the perspective that there are two narratives going on here. It doesn't help when people go on, you know, some of the more left-winged, you know, liberal news channels and start attacking Trump on everything, because all it does is polarize people. And the same thing goes on Fox News. And this is Fox News narrative. This is bread and butter for Fox News. See, it's all true. They're out to get him. He's doing a great job. He's the president of the United States and everybody's out to get him. How could he be president of the United States if at least some people weren't supporting him? I don't know.
Well, it sounds like you have a certain bone to pick with the liberal press in this country, Mike, and I know that that's not entirely what you've intended.
No, all I'm saying is that there's two narratives here, yeah. And something in the middle is probably the more acceptable.
Well, I think the other part that's going on here is that, you know, what he did with his text messaging and all that sort of stuff was probably standard operating procedure. It's what people always do pre-Trump. You know, I think that's probably, if you look at other people in government, they probably use their personal stuff, like personal emails and personal, and using their government phone to send a text that was sort of personal, which this was. We need to remember he's railing against this person, and now this person's gotten fired without any retirement or health care. But Trump himself is using his personal email for government purposes. So it's just like, you know, the rules never apply to anybody.
I don't think Trump emails. Two, this does certainly feed the narrative.
Takes too much composure.
Well, that means being able to write a simple sentence. Sentence.
Okay. This certainly does feed the narrative. You put what has gone on with James Comey and what's happened with Peter Stroke over the last couple weeks. It does help Trump with his narrative that the FBI was out to get him. I was astounded this morning. You know, on my way in to do the radio show, I like to listen to NPR so that I kind of know what's going on. And I was astounded to hear that with the wall-to-wall coverage that the Rush investigation gets, NPR this morning didn't mention once the Stroke firing. I would think that's a pretty big news story, but NPR doesn't cover it. NPR was talking about there's now one Blockbuster video store left in the country. It's in Bend, Oregon. They're spending a lot of time on that, but nothing about the Stroke story. And so this also feeds the narrative that Trump likes to attack the press. The press is out to get me. They're not covering the stuff that helps my case. They're only covering the stuff that hurts my case.
Well, listen, JP, if what you've said is true, and we'd have to go back and listen, because a lot of people don't listen to everything that's on the radio, and then they tell us how come nobody ever said this. But let's assume it was. Then I have one thing to say. Shame on NPR.
Well, I think it probably got coverage. I just want to clarify one thing. And, JP, I wondered if you mean the same thing or if you have a different opinion than mine. When I say it feeds the narrative, I'm not saying that the FBI does, in fact, have it out for Trump and there's a deep state effort to get him. I'm not saying that whatsoever. All I'm saying is Strzok became a convenient tool to help convince people who are already convinced of that and help cement their support and sort of polarize people. And that's the unfortunate aspect of this.
Well, I don't know how unfortunate it is. I would say it's fortunate that they weeded out this guy. He wasn't just some guy on the Russia investigation. He was leading the investigation. And the FBI doesn't just fire people like, oh, some guy at NBC got fired for whatever. No, the FBI has to fire people for fireable offenses. This guy got fired for a fireable offense. He led the Russia investigation. And the news media in August, there's nothing going on in the news. We're talking about the economy of Turkey, which is a $750 billion economy. And there's no wall-to-wall coverage of the Russia investigation's big news story today, which is that Strzok got fired.
Yeah, but the thing is that when he was switched over from the Russian investigation to human resources, people within the FBI, according to the Times, are saying, well, it's not a fireable offense. And now all of a sudden it is because Trump put the pressure on.
In order for it to be a fireable offense, wouldn't they have to prove that what he said, his anti-Trump comments, actually and materially affected his execution of work on the Russian investigation or the Clinton email scandal?
That's right.
And right now it doesn't. I mean, so there was a delay in terms of how quickly he followed up with the second batch of Clinton emails.
Right, Aaron. And it's a point he has made himself when he was testifying before Congress. Show me one piece of evidence that anything I wrote in a personal opinion had anything to do with the way I've conducted these investigations.
We have to go to a break. Just a quick clarification, though, that NPR did cover the story. Yeah, they covered it on All Things Considered yesterday. And they also covered it throughout the newscast yesterday, and it was mentioned this morning. But I think your point could be.
I would say usually it's wall to wall coverage of the Russia investigation. That's all you hear, right? And this morning I was listening for an hour, didn't hear anything about Peter Strzok. Did hear about the final Blockbuster video in the country. That's in Bend, Oregon. I want to go.
I find that more interesting, actually. I have to say. I thought they were out a long time ago.
Yeah. I know, but the other 364 days a year, it's
all about
the
Russia. Does that mean I have to bring back my copy of Monty Python and the Holy Grail
good.
That I have in my closet?
It's going to cost you $17,000.
All right, we are going to take a break. We'll be right back.
For if I ever saw you, I didn't.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. So you remember when I told you that was Barb Younger and John McDaniel performing the Beatles and they're going to be at the Ankrum Opera House in Ankrum, New York? Remember when I told you that? And they're going to be there on Saturday, August 18th. Remember when I told you that?
Yeah, yeah.
I also told you an email address that was wrong. So it's now been corrected. It's ankrumoperahouse.org. Ankrumoperahouse.org for more information. So we will... We will leave that as...
But they're still there, and they're still singing Beatles songs.
That's right. Right. That yes, was... that hasn't changed. That hasn't changed. Alan, you have letters.
I do. We got a letter from Lisa, who has written before, who says, thanks for the good work. Please ask Alan not to discuss Andrew Cuomo anymore. He apparently is not capable of being fair and objective regarding Cuomo because of his deep enmity for a good governor. Governor Cuomo stands as one of the only true voices of reason right now.
So can I chime in in absolute contradiction to that letter?
Yeah.
Did you hear how Cuomo is in violation of the Bald and Golden Eagle Act of 1944? possessing?
We discussed it yesterday.
Oh, okay. My God. Yeah.
He grabbed a feather, and you're not allowed to own a feather.
Right.
You're not allowed to own You're not allowed to
Lynn told me about that this morning.
Maybe it was a hawk feather, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he said he's either going to put it in the water.
Back in the water.
In the water, or he's going to give it to the American Indian Foundation, Native American Foundation.
Okay, I heard Trump was going to pardon him.
Who, the eagle?
Well, it's a federal crime, so if he pardons him, proactive.
For a long time.
He has the authority to do so.
Yes. Yeah.
Lee says, a deeper, darker danger. When Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, the top law enforcement official of the United States, invokes Jesus and the Bible verse to justify the zero tolerance policy on immigration and separating people from their families, is introducing the beginning of a Christian version of Sharia law in America. Freedom of religion is also freedom from religion. And I think that is the point of the First Amendment, by the way. I think
yes,
that's what the First Amendment is all about.
And yeah, and their religious freedom task force out of the Justice Department is very, very scary, and it's going to be going after LGBT people. It's going to be going after reproductive health, all on religious grounds, on one particular group of people's religious grounds, not on everybody. So religious freedom is not freedom to discriminate.
How would the Justice Department go after LGBT people based on that? How would they do that?
Well, first of all, they would reverse, which they've already done, Obama-era Justice Department opinions about how certain laws already cover LGBT people. They will come out against a national non-discrimination law. They will continue to undermine any work that's being done to bring non-gender identity discrimination to the states. You know, and they are working. Look, this guy who's coming in, the Kavanaugh, who knows? There will be another case that will all go all the way up to the Supreme Court on marriage, whether it's, you know, the legality of somebody getting married or a cake being made, and they'll undermine LGBT rights that way.
Okay, and Susan says FBI had to fire him. What kind of standards would it demonstrate are acceptable to keep him? Could easily erode the integrity of the other employees. That's what Susan had to say. Okay, and let's see here. Reber said, I don't know what that is. Okay, he said, Turkey discussion. Thank you for the clear discussion about Turkey's economy. Comparison from other economies. Oh, it's Lenore. I'm so sorry. From other economies and the worldwide considerations. Although we agree with your typical comments about the disastrous results of the Trump presidency, we would rather hear learned factual discussion of specific issues. Oh, let me just say, Lenore, you have every right to write anything you want, and we treasure your remark. But I got to tell you, we are so lucky to have Aaron Pacetti here. I mean, he did do a remarkable job, in my opinion, this morning in putting this all out there.
Wasn't that what she was saying?
Thank you for your clear discussion about Turkey's economic...
I think she's saying that normally she would like more of that and less of the other stuff.
Although we agree with it. I see. Okay, and then I do apologize. Okay. Thank you, Lenore.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I just want to say how much we treasure Aaron here.
Yeah.
And Bill says, Trump-Putin, some of Trump's choices suggest a deliberate and well-planned strategy that could well have been engineered by someone with the will and intent to implement a coup ahead of or in conjunction with the midterm elections. Whose job is it to anticipate Putin's next puppetry move? And that's William of Bill or Bill in Woodstock.
All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we will be we'll continue. We want to talk about NDAs and other cool things, non-disclosure agreements.
Oh, yes.
And
we want to talk about it.
Yes, we want to talk. We'll disclose what we know after this short break.
All those places had their moments with lovers and friends. I still can recall some are dead and some.
Listening to Barb Younger and John McDaniel perform The Beatles. They're going to be at the Ankrum Opera House in Ankrum on Saturday, ankrumoperahouse.org. We have some letters, and we'll get back into other discussions as soon as we finish those off.
Okay, so Judy says from Hanacroy, NPR coverage is not wall-to-wall Mueller. Selective hearing can be an obstacle to productive discussion. NPR's breadth of coverage seems to me to have broadened this summer. They also have a more varied range of commentators. How do I know? I hear more analysis now that irritate me or make me angry. They also maintain their practice of seasoning complicated reports with light content like the video store story, no dead air when broadcasting, right? Thank you for that. And Strzok's email says, Chris from Albany, it's very frustrating to hear the argument that liberal criticism of Trump is out of line or misguided because Trump will use it in bad faith, utterly ridiculous narrative about his prosecution by the deep state. And that's Chris. Well, you know, my reaction to that last letter is it is really frightening and really you can see it in its historical perspective that you just keep telling the big lie. It's just that 1984 arrived a little late.
All right. Let's move to other stories and go to non-disclosure agreements. This is, of course, a story that comes out of the Omarosa story that broke over the weekend with the release of her new book and the tape recordings that she had of her conversations with, among other people, the President of the United States. So Washington Post reports that everyone signed one. Trump is aggressive in his use of non-disclosure agreements, even in government. President Trump's bitter fight with a former top White House aide has highlighted his aggressive and unconventional use of non-disclosure agreements to prevent current and former government employees from revealing secrets or disparaging him or his family. The latest uproar centers on claims in a book by former senior advisor Omarosa Manigault Newman that the Trump campaign offered her a $15,000 a month job in exchange for signing a broadly worded NDA that would have barred her from disclosing details of her time in the White House. Trump shot back in a tweet Monday that wacky Omarosa already has a fully signed non-disclosure agreement, the first apparent acknowledgement by Trump that he used such documents as a president. The president is tweeting about Omarosa this morning, calling her a lowlife and a dog in his tweet. And I asked this question earlier. I will ask it again in this context, which is it's hard to know who to root for in this contest, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I watched the first season of The Apprentice, and she was not a nice person. Although, as Lynn reminded me, it's all edited. But just the same, I mean, she was edited consistently. But, you know, this is, once again, Trump calling somebody a dog. He called a woman a dog. He called Rosie O'Donnell a pig. This is part and parcel to, you know, his grab 'em philosophy. So, you know, it's
you know, just... You know that Roselle, my wife, has taken that quote, the famous quote.
Yes.
About
the grab 'em.
Yeah,
right.
And the thing, and put it on a T-shirt.
T-shirt, yeah.
And it's selling like... wildfire. Yeah.
You know, did you ever think that by him saying that Omarosa had a NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, it kind of validates that everything she's
That's
saying
right.
is true.
It's very true. I mean, one needs to wonder why he insists in his private business and now in his quasi-public business that everybody sign a non-disclosure.
But Libby, don't you think in a private business, okay.
Yeah,
we don't
in
like
a private
it.
Business.
But public, where every right. candidate for office talks about, including him, talks about transparency
That's
and
right.
the need for more transparency. We got to have right. transparency. Yeah. Not so much.
No, absolutely.
But it's more than a non-disclosure agreement. He offered her, Omarosa, a $180,000 a year job in exchange for signing a non-disclosure agreement.
I guess that's called a bribe. What do you
think? You know, I didn't want to use that word. Economists like the word incentive, I think.
Well, it's an incentive.
It's an incentive to sign it. But it highlights the point that there are other ways to have your employees and aides be loyal, and that is you lead by example and you don't call people dogs and lowlifes so that the first thing they want to do is go out and disparage you.
Well, Aaron, I have to say that I should have done my homework like the rest of you have done. But in terms of this trade you sign the agreement, you get a $180,000 a year job. Can you remind us of how that happened? I mean, how, I don't get
I mean, I think she is saying that is one of the things that happened. I mean, that's part of the interview.
One of the stipulations.
She's been doing, you know, that she could get this job with some lobby or something where she'd be traveling around the country and go away quietly and have a good job. But you know, this is just part of that culture of paying off people who have information that can be damaging to you. You know, we saw it with Stormy Daniels. We saw it with the Playboy Bunny. We see it probably a lot more, you know, and we're probably going to hear a lot more about it from Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, because he's got hundreds of tapes, apparently. I mean, it's going to come back to haunt him. I think it's come back to haunt him already.
Well, and I think, too, in that why you would offer money to sign an NDA, why would Omarosa sign an NDA if she wasn't being offered something? That's typically how one gets people, disgruntled employees on the way out the door, to sign NDAs. I'm not sure of the legality of this. I think it's unprecedented in government. It would certainly, if true, would violate a number of the laws. Like, you know, once Trump and his crew is out of the White House, all of those records then belong to the government and the people of the United States and not Trump as he leaves. So I think it's possible that, one, it's illegal, and that, two, they're certainly... NDAs are historically very unenforceable. People can't be barred from telling the truth about what happened to them.
But to Mike's earlier point that I believe he made off air and not on air, but if that's not true, remind me, which is that shouldn't the larger story be, not to rehash what was discussed yesterday, but shouldn't the larger story be that she was put in a position of power, she was put in a position in the White House, with access to the president? How many pictures are there of her sitting right next to him? And by many accounts, is just a little wacky.
Well,
if not a lot wacky.
Well, not only that, but not competent. She had no public policy experience, just like everybody else that he's put in. By the way, she never signed the non-disclosure agreement. But, you know, the other part of this, which we did talk about yesterday, was John Kelly's threat. In the Situation Room, of all places, where it did manage to get recorded, that, you know, if you go away quietly, then there won't be a threat to your reputation. But if you don't, then there will be. Well, and she got out of the gate first.
I think that probably happens a lot more in a lot of administrations, not just the Trump administration, where there are these backroom deals of, you know, saying, go quietly, I'll scratch your back a couple years down the road so it doesn't look this obvious. I think Trump's just making this explicit in something that's been going on, whether it's Obama administration appointees who have these cushy jobs, you know, on the board of directors of Citibank now, or Clinton-era appointees. So this happens Democrat and Republican in both administrations, but it just seems so explicit now that it's kind of shocking.
His bodyguard his body man who had to, you know, leave because he was doing online gambling is now getting $15,000 a month from the RNC. I mean, there's a lot of payoffs going on all over this administration.
Well, you also have to wonder, someone like a Sean Spicer, who has come out and written a generally positive book, if you're in Sean Spicer's position, you could be making a lot more money by publishing a critical book. Why is Sean Spicer putting out a relatively positive book? Did he sign an NDA? Did he get a payment for basically being a happy camper after leaving the White House?
Or maybe he got promised something.
Yeah, I was going to say he could be playing the long game of, yeah, sure, you know, I'll wait it out a few years and then hopefully something else will come up down the road and my reputation won't be as tarnished as Omarosa's at this
point.
Well,
it is to Joe's prowess that he's got Sean Spicer coming on today.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yeah. And
well, it won't be aired, but we're taping it tomorrow.
But I'm sure he'll ask that question.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing to remember is that that's what Omarosa's job was. It was to sit next to Trump and have his photo, you know, taken or his video on TV. You know, he said he used it to say, see, I have black people around me. I understand. I'm diverse. I listen to people who are black. So I know all about my fellow Americans who are African-American. See, I mean, it's
very true.
It's so obvious. And it's not for African-Americans. It's for his other narrative. And that, you know?
It's as obvious as having the one black guy sitting behind Trump when he's giving his speech.
His speech, right.
But the pictures at Fort Drum yesterday was very well orchestrated because you had Hispanic as well as black armed enlisted guys and women and white soldiers behind him as well. So he showed a more diverse backdrop there, which was fascinating.
And as long as we're on the subject, I want to say very quickly, we're getting a lot of mail about people who want us to talk about Stefanik and her relationship with the president.
You mean Stefanik?
Yeah, Stefanik, right.
Elise Stefanik, the member of Congress from the North Country of New York.
Got that wrong, yeah.
Well, yeah. I do think that's fascinating that there are these members of Congress for which if you had anything to do with Trump, you would be voted out of office certainly in November. And he goes up to the Southern Tier and to Fort Drum and is embraced by Congresswoman Stefanik and Congresswoman Tenney because his numbers up there in that part of the state are so strong. Whereas if he was in, you know, Long Island or New York City, it would be certainly
he couldn't go to New York
arm,
City.
Right.
To which I would say not so fast, because remember they invited him weeks and weeks ago, and so it may well be that things have changed. And by the time of the election, things are going to change even more. You do have a guy named Mueller sitting out there ready to do his thing.
Right, and I don't think that their embrace was without risk for them. That it could certainly turn, for both of those members of Congress, both of whom have reasonable challengers in November.
But they know their base, and that could, like you said, that could it's a calculated risk, and it could be an advantage, or it could be something that comes back to haunt them.
Yeah,
it all depends what happens over the next 10 weeks.
Okay, and Donna says, hi, panel, great show. What makes the Strzok firing alarming is the fact that the original recommendation from the disciplinary committee was for a demotion, a 60-day suspension. We had mentioned that earlier today. This was overruled by Deputy Director Bowditch, and he was fired. It seems political to me, and that is a shame.
Yeah, the Deputy Director had to write a report that became the ammunition they needed to fire him. It was just almost, it was like the one that Rod Rosenstein had to write to fire Comey. I mean, you put together the case, and then you use that to defend what is amounting to getting rid of your, you know, someone you regard as an adversary within the organization.
Okay, and Frank says, Trump and Stefanik, good morning, panel. Can you speak to how Trump belittled our missing in action Representative Stefanik by saying he was ignoring her calls during his Fort Drum speech? Embarrassment on another level. This district needs to be flipped in November, and that's Frank in Warren County. Now, I do believe that the reports were that he was having fun with her.
Yes, it was a backhanded compliment.
Yes.
Because she was so persistent,
right?
And that's what you need in
Congress. That I finally came here.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's all.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Moving on to other stuff, if we can. And
although I have to say one last thing, we can find her. You know, on Congressional Corner, she keeps saying she's coming, like the Vindo Viper story.
What about Claudia Tenney? Does she come? Does she ever come on?
I think she...
No, I don't
know. No,
so.
Maybe not.
She's
no.
They're both missing in action.
Although I will say that the candidate in that race, the Democratic candidate in that race, Tedra Cobb, is on Congressional Corner today.
And by the way, extremely articulate.
Yes, she's good. And Anthony Brandisi, who's running against Tenney, has been here as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on to other stuff. Let's talk about Stephen Miller.
Oh, gosh.
So, Stephen Miller's uncle has written an op-ed and calls his nephew an immigration hypocrite.
And then proves that a lot of his family would not have been able to be here because they would have, you know, they would have been in the Holocaust.
They would have died.
David Glosser, who is Miller's uncle, wrote an op-ed in Politico, and what the subject at hand is chain migration, which of course the president
family reunification.
Yes, exactly. So Wolf Lieb Glosser fled violence from a small Eastern European village, and with $8 to his name, came to Ellis Island. His children soon followed, and his children's children were born in the American city of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, where the family grew and prospered. Such is what chain migration was like at the turn of the 20th century, and such is the classically American tale of the ancestors of White House senior advisor Stephen Miller. All of this according to the uncle. Glosser called his Glosser called his nephew the key driver of President Trump's America First agenda an immigration hypocrite. He lambasted Miller's role in crafting the Trump administration hawkish immigration policies, namely the travel ban, the zero tolerance crackdown at the border that led to the separation of thousands of migrant children and their families, and the effort to curtail legal immigration. Thanksgiving is going to be so awkward. Oh, my God.
Well, in fairness, this guy doesn't know him very well. He said that he's only met Stephen Miller, his nephew, a few times.
But I want to ask Joe. Joe may be the best uncle in the entire world. He really may be.
He's an uncle to all of us.
And not only to all of us, but he is wonderful to his many... His many nephews and nieces.
Is he more avuncular than you, Alan?
What'd you say?
Is he more avuncular than you?
Oh, avuncular, does that mean bigger? I mean, what is
uncle like?
Avuncular, I see now. Well, Joe, so I have a question for you. Can you ever imagine, this is a nephew, can you ever imagine things getting so bad within your family that you would speak out against a nephew or a niece?
Well, I don't, you know, here's the thing. If you feel that a member of your family, no matter what the relation may be, is the, how do I say this nicely, the personification of evil.
How about the son of Spawn?
Which, by the way, is not too far off the mark.
Right. No, yeah. So if you are saving your own reputation and saying, oh, God, you know, I think you could see yourself to write something that is, I'll have to say, I'm sure this goes with everyone here. You know, I was just at a family reunion over the weekend. You learn a lot about your family at these kind of things, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes your opinions change.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, but as my mother might have said, keep them to yourself.
Right. Well,
are you saying you're having a problem with the fact that his uncle wrote this piece?
No, on the contrary, I think it takes tremendous courage to do what he did.
And
it was important what he said.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, his family, if it wasn't for family sponsorship, or they call it chain migration, as a negative, they would have either in the pogroms or in the Holocaust. And Stephen Miller wouldn't be here, which, you know.
By the way, is a point that has been made over and over and over again by other people, but to have it made by a member of the
family, of
someone calling you out on it on your own family,
right.
And it seems to make a point, as Mike alluded to, the two are estranged anyway, so it doesn't really...
But it also comes a couple days after Melania Trump's parents gained citizenship through this program.
One other thing. Bobby Goodlatte, the son of House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte, said Monday he's embarrassed that his father's political grandstanding cost FBI agent Peter Strzok his job. So Congressman Goodlatte's son donated the maximum allowable contribution to his father's opponent.
Whoa.
And so
there's going to be some serious couch
that Thanksgiving that will be very
awkward.
Yeah. But I think you're going to see some more of that. I think you'll see younger people who are not so doctrinaire around this stuff see Trump and Miller as for what they are, and they may well
Ron
start
Reagan.
Doing this.
Remember?
Ron Reagan did. Right. I mean, What Stephen Miller is a blight on humanity. It's just that simple.
Okay, we're over time, but go ahead. No, go ahead.
Boy, this is going to be a weird way for me to go out. You know, Miller could make the argument that immigration was very different back in the early 20th century and in the early 21st century, that this country is a very different economic and political beast.
Yeah, let me tell you something. My grandparents, his grandparents, there were plenty of people who didn't want us to come to this country.
We'll be back after this.